Trigger warning for discussion of sexual violence. Spoiler warning for movies listed in the episode description.
There's nothing. There's nobody, or at least nobody with a radio.
All right, then let's set down. We'll use the bullhorn.
Set down? Wait a minute, that's not in our contract.
This is the biggest city within 150 miles. We're going to give it every chance.
Jesus, Mary and Joseph.
Set down, John.
I'll set us down. But I won't leave my seat, and I'll keep the engine running. Now, the first sign of trouble, I'm going up. If you ain't on board when that happens, you're likely to have a lousy afternoon.
So for the 2000s, my first rec is Thirst from 2009, directed by Park Chan-wook. I mentioned in last year's episode that in the early aughts, North America was a bit of a dead zone for horror, and East Asia was much more the locus of global horror cinema, even beyond the increasingly formulaic J-horrors about little girl yokai that all got Hollywood remakes. But director Park Chan-wook's work is one highlight of this period. He was part of the broader Korean New Wave, and his work crosses genres, but it's always very stylish and always very dark. His most famous work is probably the crossover hit Old Boy, but everything he's made is worth watching, from the tragic tale of doomed friendship between North and South Korean soldiers' joint security area, to the utterly brutal, underrated satire Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance, to the recent sapphic period thriller The Handmaiden, among others. Thirst is his most overt foray into the horror genre, a kind of vampire-priest romance. The vampire priest is played by the extremely prolific Song Kang-ho. If you've watched any Korean movies, you've almost certainly seen him. He was the dad in Parasite, and if you've seen enough, you'll know he has incredible range. Compare, for example, his charming doofus in The Host with his more restrained vampire priest here in Thirst. Vampirism and Thirst, much like we've talked about in other works, is a sexual plague. Unmistakably reminiscent of AIDS again. This is far from uncommon in the genre, but the way Park Chan-wook portrays the medical angle is distinctive, showing a slow onset over the course of a year, culminating in the priest feeding on patients already near death as a relatively moral alternative to straight-up murder. It's a bit like in Buffy when good vampires start using raw meat to get their sources of blood. Presumably in this universe you can only get human blood, or he hasn't thought of that angle, but he feeds on people already near death through medical means. And as his thirst grows, he breaks his vows by shacking up with a young woman, played by the award-winning Kim Ok-bin, and their conflicted romance forms the center of the story. Whereas the priest treats vampirism as a curse, the young woman experiences it as a liberation from an unpleasant family life. The conflict between these two takes on vampirism sets the second half of the movie in motion, at which point it gives up on all tonal restraint and goes completely bonkers. Park Chan-wook knows what he's doing, and the enjoyably sharp tonal turns are held together by compelling character conflict. In the end, it's an arguably conservative story, but a well-told one in any case. In terms of other East Asian horror, I'll also give honourable mentions to the Hunger Games predecessor Battle Royale, anthology Three Extremes, which lives up to the title, anything by Takashi Miike, as I'll always say, And for something lighter, the first live-action adaptation of the manga, Death Note. It's like a light teen movie, much less extreme than kind of a lot of these other films I've recommended. The original Death Note is something to watch if you want something lighter. It has all sorts of themes about power corrupting and all that, but it's all pretty fun, gothic kind of teen melodrama stuff. Again, a lighter one. My next early 2000s rec is the French In My Skin from 2002, written and directed by Marina Devan, who also stars. She plays a woman with a successful career and apparently happy hetero relationship who develops an obsession with first self-harm and even self-cannibalism, which comes off first as a kind of reactivation of the flesh, a sort of almost erotic self-exploration. It's very French. Yet also at the same time, it expresses a kind of alienation from the self, and that increasingly comes to be the case. And I think this kind of expresses that she's already alienated from herself, even in her supposedly happy life. And as she experiments with this way of reconnecting with her flesh, making herself feel things again, she again finds a new form of alienation, and she ultimately doesn't escape. At least that's my reading of it. Obviously a massive trigger warning for self-harm, but it strikes me that Marina Devan is onto something psychologically, and she plays the fixation convincingly. Casting herself in the lead works quite well. Again, it's all very French. It got 65% on Rotten Tomatoes, but 4.5 out of 5 on the clearly more reputable site Effed Up Movies. Make of that what you will. It's kind of part of the new French extreme movement, which also involved Haute Tension, which I had my issues with, and Martyrs, which I haven't touched, but I thought In My Skin was pretty interesting psychological horror.
What was that movie Haute Tension about? I kind of remember that when that kind of came over here.
I don't know if we want to give away the twist, but it's about two women who basically are out in the middle of nowhere. There's murderer, there's a twist. I don't like the twist. It has queer themes. I don't like the way it handles those queer themes. I think it's an interesting movie. In the end, not a movie that I can particularly make a case for. Finally, despite my generalization about North America in the early aughts, Canadian director Bruce MacDonald's Pontypool offers a novel take on the zombie genre, set in a radio station as a virus spread by language takes hold of the titular town of Pontypool.
Pontypool sounds pretty cool. I wasn't able to get a copy, and the one we had didn't work for me. Yeah, that sounds very interesting, language spreading zombie virus. Jennifer's Body is a 2009 American dark horror comedy film written by Diablo Cody and directed by Karen Kusama. The film stars Megan Fox, Amanda Seyfried, Johnny Simmons, and Adam Brody. Fox portrays a demonically possessed high school girl who kills her male classmates with her best friend striving to stop her. The film premiered at the 2009 Toronto International Film Festival and was released in the US and Canada on September 18th, 2009. Working with Cody again following their collaboration efforts on the film Juno, Jason Reitman stated he and his producers, quote, wanted to make unusual films. Cody said she wanted the film to speak to female empowerment and explore the complex relationships between friends. The film had a lackluster performance at the North American box office, making and receiving mixed reviews from critics, with its dialogue, emotional resonance, and performances being praised, while the narrative and uneven tone were targets for criticism. In the wake of the Me Too movement, the film has been appreciated as a feminist horror film and as a cult film, and I recommend the uncut version. Very subtly and conservatively, didn't go nuts with what it cut or added. There isn't much of a time difference, but there's very good cuts. Some scenes go on a little longer. They use some of the better scenes that were removed. The dialogue is better. Some of the more twee dialogue is removed. Yeah, it's much better all around. And I want to wreck the YouTube video about it by The Tate called Jennifer's Body and the Horrific Female Gaze. Many critics, of course, as we said, missed the point at the time, and just as the studio did, and was unsure how to market this horror movie aimed at girls by the screenwriter and director. And I agree with Vice writer Frederick Leichert with the idea that it would have been better received as the so-called art house elevated horror. And Blitchert said, quote, "It's become the kind of messaging that's more readily celebrated in, quote, prestige horror like It Follows or Get Out. Like I've said, it's flop, so promising young woman could fly. And let's not forget Teeth, for good mention." And Jordan Peele made a comment as well, saying that he doesn't like this whole elevated horror.
Well, yeah, he doesn't like the term, which I agree with. But yeah, you mentioned at the end there, promising young woman and Teeth. And yeah, I agree. These three kind of in a similar category of kind of evolved rape revenge films. And the three which I think much more center the female leads. They have much more developed complex characters, and they also have more of an emphasis on the revenge over the kind of initial violence, the initial violating act that, or inciting act that sets off the violence. And that allows them to more explore the question of women's power in the genre and women's agency in the genre, as opposed to just leaning on the exploitation and the treatment of women in the inciting act. So yeah, I think these three, yeah, can be very much viewed in connection with each other, with Teeth being definitely the most gory and extreme, and I greatly enjoy Teeth, but yeah, definitely solid. And Promising Young Woman, in a way, I think I would consider that a less successful and coherent work than Teeth and Jennifer's Body. So a bit of a hot take there. I think Promising Young Woman isn't as strong. It doesn't quite come together. There's a lot of good elements and they quite come together. Whereas Jennifer's Body and Teeth are like, they pull off what they pull off very well. They're a lot more coherent, I think. Jennifer's Body is like, it's very much camp horror. And like Juno, which I wasn't a fan of at the time. One thing I do remember is that she was a fan of Suspiria, as in the character Juno was a fan of Suspiria. Yeah. So clearly Diablo Cody is a horror fan, and that comes through in this. But yeah, and it definitely leaning on the camp side of the genre and having fun with it.
Another very strong female-led horror movie in the 2000s that came out before this was Ginger Snaps, which actually came out in 2000. I would say one of the best werewolf movies in decades, along with Dog Soldiers. So, and there's so few good werewolf movies across decades. I mean, really, I mean, you got Howling, American Werewolf in London, and the last two I just mentioned. So yeah, it's like four movies in like almost 40 years.
Again, definitely, I agree, a lot of similarities between Ginger Snaps and Jennifer's Body in terms of how they explore relationships between basically girls coming of age.
Yeah, and it treats the idea of like the way that Carrie, how it deals with getting your period for the first time and sexually repressive, religiously repressive household and being traumatized by that. And then the telekinesis kind of being a metaphor and a real thing happening at the same time there. That with this, you know, you got the werewolfism becoming a woman at the same time. And like her mom, played by Mimi Rogers, just thinking she's having her period is just hilarious.
Yeah, it's clearly monstrous puberty, and it's not subtle about that.
Yeah, I was a big fan of both movies. The other one was just like kind of a prequel that was unrelated or something that just took place in frontier times, but it was all pretty good.
Sorry, which movie?
The other Ginger Snaps movie.
All right, I haven't seen that.
Yeah, it was just the same two actresses. It took place in like Canadian frontier times, but the same scenario of the other Ginger getting bitten by a wolf.
When I said North America, or really Hollywood, wasn't the locus of global horror cinema during this period, I guess the nuance your recs have introduced is that there was some good work happening, but the more interesting work, like Jennifer's Body, was overlooked or actively maligned, while the likes of James Wan were lavished with attention in multiple sequels, and I'm not a fan of James Wan.
All those movies that weren't Warner Brothers about the hoaxers that claimed to be a bunch of real exorcists or whatever. They made like however many movies and the spin-offs with Annabelle and all that crap. Conjuring, yeah. The Nun.
The only James Wan movie I like is Malignant, and that's just because it's completely ridiculous. It's just silly.
There's a director that works with him often, another Australian director who directed The Invisible Man. I recommend that movie highly.
Right. The new Invisible Man. I've heard that's good.
It's hard to watch if you've ever dealt with or been the victim of domestic violence and gaslighting in such a degree and psychological abuse, but it's brilliant, and the main actress from Elizabeth Morse, or the actress from The Handmaid's Tale, is really good in this.
Mm, so I've heard. Do you want to do Shaun of the Dead?
Well, I thought Shaun of the Dead is a good mention from Edgar Wright. I think that was the beginning of the Coronado trilogy, correct? With Simon Pegg and Nick Frost.
Yes, yes. Leaving behind Jessica Hines, who's openly quite mad about that.
Yeah, I wondered about that, because I'm a big fan of Spaced.
Yeah, exactly. Spaced is brilliant. She was a part of their creative team, and she has basically said, yeah, it was a boys' club, and they left me behind when they went off to make Shaun of the Dead in the Cornetto trilogy, which is unfortunate. Yeah, her role in Spaced was, like, great. Like, it was such a part of, a core part of the dynamic. So, I still love the Cornetto trilogy, but, you know, they would be stronger if Jessica Hines was more than like a brief cameo in Shaun of the Dead. But yeah.
Their second movie they did, Hot Fuzz, was pretty good too, as a horror, as a spoof. Mm.
Again, very homoerotic.
Yeah, it was a spoof of Wicker Man, of course, and Bad Boys. How do you splice Bad Boys and Wicker Man together in a single movie? I think that's brilliant. And we mentioned The Host earlier, and I just further recommend that movie and every movie by that filmmaker. That was a great movie and a beginning of seeing a very good series of, like, when I see this director and I see he's got a new movie coming out, I know I'm gonna like it. I know something interesting's coming, no matter what genre he's doing.
Yeah, and his belated recognition at the Oscars with Parasite, it was Korean New Wave kind of finally getting noticed by the Oscars. You know, I guess better late than never. Bong Joon-ho is always worth a watch, for sure. Moving into the 2010s, again, we mentioned last time that the 2010s were a bit of a renaissance for Western horror. I'm going to start with some honorable mentions that haven't received as much attention. Firstly, 2018's Summer of 84 by a trio of directors known as the Roadkill Superstars. I found out about this due to a short YouTube video essay by Ryan Hollinger. Basically, it starts as a Stranger Things style nostalgia fest, 80s suburban kids investigating a horror mystery, in this case a possible serial killer who is the lead's neighbor and a cop. However, without spoiling the specifics, the last act is what sets this apart from similar nostalgia pieces. One inherent issue with Stranger Things is that it can never fully commit to the horror because they're kids and the audience wouldn't accept various lines being crossed. I include myself in that. You know, I don't want them to kill Max. I don't want them to kill Eleven. You don't want them to kill Billy. Was it Billy? Steve, same diff. You don't want him to kill the doofusy older guy.
The way I see it, I think Steve is probably the only one they can kill. And that's unfortunate.
Yeah, well, because he's older. Yeah, point being, they can't fully commit to the horror because it's a bunch of kids and none of us want that. We're watching it for something a bit kinder than that.
Killing the innocents of the time, yeah. This movie, I think I watched the same video as you, and as the further I got, I was like, I started realizing where this was going. And I was like, I do not want to know anymore. 84 or see this movie.
yeah. So Summer of 84 completely crosses that line, the line that we don't want to be crossed in Stranger Things, in the climax of the movie. Completely jettisons the comforting blanket of nostalgia and fully commits to the horror of the premise. That was difficult to watch, but I respected it. I'll also say it's not to do with going over the top with gore or anything. It's more just that it really conveys the horror of the concepts. It's as much psychological as committing to the violence of the concept. Yeah, I think it's a really strong third act, but a horrifying third act.
Yeah, I saw a French movie years ago that kind of took the Home Alone scenario and did it realistic and changed me forever.
Yeah, I won't say this changed me because I'm already too traumatized, but I will say that it was horrific and that it impressed me. But another honorable mention goes to 2018's Knife Plus Heart, directed and co-written by Yann Gonzalez. This is a queer giallo. So if, like me, you're in the overlap of queer cinema fans and fans of giallo like Dario Argento's work, this is for you.
Well, yes, it is for me.
For one thing, simply the lighting. The lighting has all the sort of garish beauty of something like Suspiria, you know, just the full color spectrum cinema.
So do you think that is where bisexual lighting comes from?
I can see that. Yeah, Dario Argento, he has bisexual lighting, but I feel like he has every kind of complementary lighting. In Suspiria in particular, he loves to have like two complementary colors in very much the middle of the color spectrum for that color, incredibly red and incredibly blue or something like that. Yeah, so Knife Plus Heart is similar, and it's pretty much club lighting, you know, like it's in the dark and the lighting is all incredibly colorful, and some of it is set in clubs. But warning, this is Knife Plus Heart, obviously. Warning deals with queerphobic violence and abuse, though it also has a satisfyingly cathartic climax, so you may at least feel some release by the end. I certainly did, but giallo, you can generally expect some murders.
And I would go back and add content warning for Summer of 84 as well, and just let that stand.
I feel like my description of the last act kind of pretty much indicated that. But yeah, as I say, done very well. I respect it. It's not like I've already badmouthed Saw on this podcast.
Well, you know, it's good to have violence that actually fits the story in a way, like that means something artistically and substantively like that, rather than just like, ooh, look how shocking and edgy we can be. It just for the sake of it. And we've gotten to that point under torture porn and stuff like the Centipede movie that just like shock for shock's sake, but no substance.
Yeah, I was just saying about Saw, like, I don't respect all horrific cinema, so I don't respect Saw. It's also to do with the semiotics or the meaning of the story. So with Saw, I feel like it's leaning into violence as punishment, which generally not something I like in the slasher genre, and Saw is like taking that in the slasher genre and escalating the idea of violence punishment.
It's ripping off Seven. It's like, hey, we saw Seven, how do we top Seven?
Whereas Summer of 84 is about the underlying horror of suburbia and the sort of a little bit Lynchian, because David Lynch has sort of come to slightly define the whole underlying horror of suburbia. I think what it's doing semiotically with the violence is more interesting. I'll also rec two weird niche horrors starring my fave Natasha Lyonne of But I'm a Cheerleader, Orange is the New Black, and Russian Doll fame. So those are relatively prominent, but she's been willing to star in all sorts of weird crap. Firstly, 2010's extremely camp meta comedy All About Evil, directed by Joshua Granel, also known by their drag persona Peaches Christ. All About Evil stars Natasha Lyonne as a serial killer who turns her kills into short films to save the small cinema she runs. This movie, All About Evil, isn't good by conventional standards, but it's campy fun, especially if you enjoy the likes of Roger Corman, which it's clearly influenced by. It's hard to find, but it is on the horror streaming service. Shudder. If you're outside North America, you might need a VPN, but it's on there. The other niche Natasha Lyon horror is 2016's Antibirth, directed and written by Danny Perez, who otherwise just makes music videos, and it shows as this has a lot of style. Antibirth is a body horror about a mysterious pregnancy, which perfectly captures chemically altered defamiliarization. So if you want to see the experience of being incredibly stoned and also concerned about what's happening with your body represented, then watch Antibirth. That's probably a niche pleasure, but it's one that I enjoyed. After watching Antibirth, I also recommend Joe Isaacson's review of it in the Blindfields Journal, which I've mentioned before.
Defamiliarization, is that something like when you can't recognize yourself in the mirror?
It's what it sounds like. It's not necessarily defamiliarization with yourself, although it could be that. Defamiliarization with things in general, as in things that you're familiar with become less familiar. So what's a good example of defamiliarization? It's like if you describe something in such terms that it becomes strange. You've seen the comic by the pro-lifer, the aliens, describing human life, right?
Strange Planet by Nathan W. Pyle.
That's all about defamiliarization. Like, it's describing things that are familiar to us in ways that are unfamiliar to us. Also, the First Nations zombie horror Blood Quantum, written and directed by recently passed away Mi'kmaq writer-director Jeff Barnaby. Rest in peace. And a couple of Global South horrors. Firstly, 2018 Bollywood flick Tumbad, written and directed by Rahi Anil Bhave with other collaborators. The story concerns the ancient being Hasta, the goddess of prosperity's first son. Originally concealed from popular mythology due to his dangerous avarice, but revived in the early 20th century. It's well produced with a certain period grit, some great effects sequences, and for better or worse, no musical numbers.
Yeah, I've heard of this one. I was wondering how this one was.
Yeah, Tumbad, it's definitely worth a watch. It's an interesting one. It's a bit of a slow burn around the middle. It's definitely a mix of kind of historical drama and kind of supernatural horror. So it's definitely interesting.
Yeah, I was just going to say that this next one is really good. It almost didn't even come off as supernatural for the longest time. And I'm really glad that you recommended this.
So that's 2019 Senegalese supernatural horror Atlantis, even more so than Tumbad. Starts off kind of a social realist drama, but then goes in an interesting supernatural direction. That's written and directed by Mati Diop in her featured directorial debut. This confident debut deals with workers' rebellion, women's liberation, and a kind of embrace of subaltern monstrosity. It's available on Netflix. Any more comments on that one?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it, and it also had a little bit of subversive message too, along with its anti-capitalist, the pro-labor messages there about people, you know, building all these disgusting skyscrapers for the UAE and Dubai and stuff, wherever. And also, you know, really the focus on the fact that they had to go to Spain, you know, and cross over into Europe to get more jobs.
As I say, it sort of starts off feeling like a social realist kind of film, and then the supernatural element really works quite well to bring out a whole political dimension that you wouldn't have without it. Like, yeah, it's a really interesting kind of use of supernatural horror.
Yeah, I won't spoil how it does, but when you see that it starts to, you realize it.
Yeah, and supernatural horror is often not my favorite, but in this case it uses it really well. Attack the Block from 2011 by director Joe Gornish, in which aliens, well, attack the block, specifically a London housing estate, which some hoods must defend from the alien invasion. I've been a fan of Joe Cornish ever since the Adam and Joe show, an honestly brilliant show on BBC's music podcasts. His debut as a feature film writer-director is very confident, polished, and just a pleasure to watch. He cites Walter Hill and John Carpenter as influences on the visual style, saying he wanted to get away from the depressing visual style common in British cinema. Despite the relatively gritty setting of a council estate, he was a comedian by trade first, and the script is often very funny, but he doesn't rely on his comedy chops. He really puts in the work to make a well-rounded piece of entertainment. In some ways, it's a bit like Edgar Wright with the Cornetto trilogy in that way, where they're both very funny writers, but they don't rely on that. They kind of put in the work to make an interesting genre mix and to make it, you know, visually sophisticated and all that. So it's a much more, again, rounded piece of entertainment than sometimes you get from comedians in cinema or comedy writers in cinema. He's helped by an excellent cast. So John Boyega gets to be way more of a badass here as a 15-year-old kid. Then he got to be in 3 Star Wars movies as a Force-sensitive rebel. You'd think he had more opportunities to be a badass in that case. But the rest of the young actors also nail their often quite funny roles. There's also future Dr. Jodie Whittaker. Her role initially plays on white woman vulnerability, but ultimately subverts it by portraying the Hoods as sympathetic protectors and challenging middle-class racism.
Have you got a boyfriend?
Yeah.
Are you sure about him? Where is he? Because he ain't exactly looking out for you tonight.
He's in Ghana.
You go out with an African man?
No, he's helping children. He volunteers for the Red Cross.
Oh, is it? Why can't he help the children of Britain? Not exotic enough, is it? They're getting a nice suntan.
It also has Nick Frost, who's always nice to see. The aliens, or gorilla wolf motherfuckers, as described in the movie, have a simple and effective design. I particularly like the way their neon green teeth stand out against their jet black fur. This is just a really fun movie, and the distinctive combination of council estate, social commentary, sci-fi horror, and comedy works perfectly.
I'm shitting myself in it, but at the same time...
What?
This is sick.
Do you have any comments on that one?
Yeah, I really enjoyed this movie the first time I saw it, and watched it again pretty recently, and just was reminded how good this really was. And then I really realized, yeah, that is Jodie Whittaker. And that's the new Doctor. Okay. You know, because I didn't know it back then, obviously, but I saw it closer to when it was released. But you see how the people like her and John Boyega starred in it then would go on to flesh out a lot of, you know, better careers and role. Yeah, like you said, his career in acting and charisma was wasted on the Star Wars sequels, unfortunately.
It has some established actors like Nick Frost, but also, as you say, catches some other actors relatively early in their career, catches some quite talented actors. Whittaker's an interesting one because, I mean, I also knew about her from Broadchurch, which is really good, and she's been kind of screwed over in the writing of Doctor Who. I'll just say very briefly that she's a great actor. There is a problem with current Doctor Who, but it's the writing, not her. She's great in everything.
I've been unsure about how to approach the new show and who to believe and what's the story with that, because just so many people just hate her so much just because she is a woman as the Doctor.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's a case of the anti-woke people are attacking it for the wrong reason, but it also just isn't very well written. Anyway, we should probably not talk too much about Doctor Who. Anything else on Attack the Block?
I definitely like the design of the aliens and the fact that they were almost like black holes in a way, or able to kind of like cancel out light, then the irony of all that light that was on their teeth and the inside of their mouth and everything was the only thing that made visible. And it was kind of a chiaroscuro effect when they were in different places and with the neon and all that.
Yeah, right. They don't reflect the light at all. They kind of remind me of the shadow ships in Babylon 5 in that respect, and that they're just darkness. And so when they're in the darkness, they're just part of it. And then when they emerge from it, they're like dark, blotting out everything else. And I kind of wonder if part of it is that, you know, it's a good design, but it's also a good way of concealing CG, because famously, if you want to conceal CG, you put it in darkness. But in this case, just making making them completely black. You don't have to have the details, you know, you don't have to worry about the fur being having sort of, you know, reflections or the kind of complexities you can get. It's a really good, simple design, and the simplicity is like makes it effective.
Yeah, and you couldn't tell when it would jump between puppet and animation that well that way.
I imagine they probably would have done some color work on the puppets just to make them darker. Like, yeah, it does match up well. Good fun movie. But my next pick for the 2010s is 10 Cloverfield Lane, 2016, directed by Dan Trachtenberg, who in my books is two for two in making better sequels than the originals with this and the recent Prey. You probably know the story of 10 Cloverfield Lane, but just in case, it's a sequel to a kaiju disaster movie, with this entry showing three people holed up in a bunker dominated by John Goodman, the paranoid crank who owns the bunker. This movie was criticized for being awkwardly stitched onto an existing franchise.
It's kind of a mix of kaiju and alien invasion, whereas the first one was straight up kaiju, you know, because it was like there was some kind of disaster, but we weren't being told what exactly it was or didn't see a sign of what it was till, you know, much later in the movie. And I think your point here, too, is a good point that shows the stupidity of this criticism, is that criticizing it for being awkwardly stitched onto an existing franchise, but like the whole point of doing the Cloverfield things is that this is an anthology. Each movie is different, but technically in a strange way related, like the Tales from the Crypt movies.
The concept wasn't originally developed as a sequel, but it always had an apocalypse happening above the surface. That's pretty essential to the story. The fact that the apocalypse is provided by an existing intellectual property is fine. There's no reason a sequel should have to directly, narratively follow on from the first. And this tells a story that both adds to the universe and also tells its own distinct story. It's not like Joker, where the addition to the universe doesn't actually make sense. In 10 Cloverfield Lane, the connection isn't direct, but it does work to flesh out the universe in a way that makes sense. Unfortunately, the third entry, the Cloverfield Paradox, kind of sucked, although its cosmic horror ambitions were admirable. 10 Cloverfield Lane is more of a psychological horror, and it has uniformly excellent performances, with the obvious standout being John Goodman's frankly terrifying Howard.
I'm always watching. Always. I go wherever I want.
I don't know.
I know what you're doing. I see what you're doing. I know what you're up to.
Look, Howard, I don't know what you're getting at.
I see you when you're sleeping. I know what you're doing. And I'm always watching. I'm always watching.
Santa Claus. There's Santa Claus.
Yeah, Michelle, that's great. Except that it's Emmett's turn.
Rewatching this to take notes for the podcast, one was simply all caps, John Goodman is so fucking good.
Damn straight. Where's this man's Oscar?
Indeed. Just to make a dig at YouTube's Cinema Sins, I know they claim to be satire, but whatever. In their Everything Wrong with 10 Cloverfield Lane video, they of course counted it as a sin that Goodman was portrayed as crazy, but was actually correct. Yeah, God forbid movies involve any kind of complexity that can't be immediately grasped by two lazy guys churning out low-effort clickbait and calling it satire. This might seem petty, and it is, but I mention it because what they call a sin is precisely what makes this movie brilliant. When we first meet Howard, the obvious question is whether he's telling the truth about an apocalypse outside his bunker or on a power trip. The horrifying answer, of course, is both. Incidentally, not a spoiler given this is a sequel. Just a content warning, Goodman's character is psychologically abusive, and as a survivor of psychological abuse myself, I think this is an excellent portrayal of a controlling, paranoid man who seems to genuinely think he's helping people. If you understandably don't want to watch that, do not watch 10 Cloverfield Lane. But it's not just Goodman's character that makes this movie. This is a generally strong three-hander. It almost feels like a play with the contained character drama, something like absurdist theater, where the trauma of apocalyptic upheaval plays out on an intimate scale. We have Marie Elizabeth Winstead as Michelle, the protagonist who has a history of running away from problems and has to find the strength to fight the monsters inside and outside the bunker. John Gallagher Jr. is also solid as Emmett, a younger man who already knew Howard and begins with divided loyalties. The three come to represent a kind of Oedipal nightmare family, controlling father, terrified but resourceful daughter, and a son who bonds with the daughter, a bond the father sees as a challenge to his authority. Trachtenberg's direction emphasizes the claustrophobia of the setting effectively, with framing that centers tightly on the leads. This is pitch-perfect psychological horror, with a streak of jet-black comedy and a sci-fi horror climax, which Trachtenberg also nails. 10 out of 10 movie, no notes.
I agree with that grade, with that rating.
Yeah, it's genuinely quite excellent. Intense, in my view, in a good way.
Yeah, it makes more sense by the third one, yeah, how the first two are related. Well, it was definitely a different creature, because that wasn't the creature from under the sea, though. I mean, that was a spaceship. Those were aliens.
So it's a different creature, but the whole thing about that incursion is that it's not just one creature. It's a whole reality incursion. And the third one is establishing how the whole incursion into our reality happens.
Different things, different worlds, different parallel universes leaking.
Yeah, well, I never really had much trouble with how the first two are related. I never found that confusing. I just thought it's just set in a different place and focused on different characters, you know?
But yeah, that was a very good movie, and Trachtenberg just came right out the gates with a good one. And, I mean, just acting-wise was excellent. And then with Prey, I mean, how many people have a second movie that's that phenomenal?
Yeah, it is impressive that he's made two movies. Considering the two movies, like, you would expect that he was maybe someone who'd have to have worked a bit to establish himself to make these kind of risks with franchise cinema and have them pay off so well. Like, maybe Rian Johnson kind of style, although there's a bigger backlash. But, you know, Rian Johnson had really established himself with previous works, whereas Dan Trachtenberg just comes from nowhere with these really novel takes on existing concepts.
Keeping with Bad Robot Productions here, 2018 American action horror film Overlord, that was directed by Julius Avery. An initial story for the film was conceived by J.J. Abrams and screenwriter Billy Ray, who's also had pretty good batting average, with Ray penning the script. Paramount acquired the script in 2017, and Mark L. Smith was brought on to polish it. It was originally, for the longest time, said to be the fourth Cloverfield anthology movie. They seemed like they changed that last minute, and now they deny it ever was. They decided that, either way, that this was a movie that they could stand alone and kind of put some money behind, and I thought it worked. And overall, in tone and everything else, like the star said, given its time period, that they decided to go for movie over accuracy. It stars Jovan Adepo, Wyatt Russell, who's the son of Kurt Russell, Matilda Olivier, John Magaro, Gianni Telfer, Pilo Asbach, Joaquin Woodbine, and Ian DeCastaker, who was on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. He's a really funny guy. The film was produced by J.J. Abrams through Bad Robot, a production banner. Plot followed several American soldiers who are dropped behind the enemy lines the day before D-Day, as the name is a tie to, because Overlord was the code name for D-Day at the time. They discover these terrifying Nazi experiments, and Nazi zombies ensue. And for me, you know, I think that's like one of the things that was a major failure of Zack Snyder's movie, was that it had, like, Sucker Punch, is that it had World War I German zombies, when Nazi zombies right there.
I agree, total missed opportunity to have Nazi zombies.
This was like Wolfenstein the movie, I think, for me.
Yeah, I think it worked. It was no 10 Cloverfield Lane, but few movies are. The gore effects in this worked quite well. They had sort of different tonal use of gore effects in different sequences. So the early scenes of medical experimentation were kind of reminiscent of actual atrocities. Without going fully graphic, they hinted at atrocities.
Yeah, like, that was a good point, because, you know, that was part of what they're talking about. They didn't want to be overly gory in showing, like, atrocities, and also they decided not to get into, well, if we're going to be accurate, you know, Kurt Russell's son is going to be racist towards the black soul, and there we'd have to deal with the fact there's the segregation of the armed forces.
Well, I think specifically the choice to not go really graphic on the atrocities was a good choice, because it could get into, like, torture porn based on actual historical facts, even though these particular experiments are kind of made up. Even so, it would still feel like if they did go graphic, it'd be kind of torture porn in the context of actual Nazi atrocities. So I think they're just sort of hinting at it and showing you, like, for example, that someone's burnt alive, but we just see the flames, we don't see the person being burnt alive, stuff like that. It's just enough, and it, you know, it doesn't feel like the sort of movie where going graphic would have helped. I don't know, like, something like Schindler's List is quite graphic, but this is not Schindler's List. So for something that's slightly more sort of campy or action, I think it was better to sort of imply this stuff rather than going really graphic. And then once you're dealing with zombies, you're obviously in a totally different ballpark. It's a bit more fantastical, and they started to go a bit more graphic there. So you had the sort of torn up zombie face, and I think they judged well when to kind of go graphic and when not. And the use of death rattles was also effective. They kind of built up tension with the sound of death rattles a lot, and that is sort of part of the onset of the zombie plague. So yeah, I found that effective as well, like rasping kind of last breaths before death, if people don't know what that term actually means.
I didn't notice it.
I thought they used it a lot to kind of build up the tension for the zombification. Like, it seemed like part of the sort of final stages before zombification were these kind of death rattles and kind of basically raspy breathing. I mean, frankly, probably part of the reason I noticed it was because I recently had somebody passed away in the family and I heard a death rattle in real life for the first time. So I was noticing it in this, and I thought it was a really effective way of kind of building up the tension towards the zombification, and that this was a part of, like, the sort of final stages of basically their life kind of thing.
Do you know
where
the cutoff is and when the zombie part starts?
Yeah, I thought it was effectively creepy and effectively building the sense of, like, that this is, yeah, the last stage before death or undeath in this case. It's also cool, incidentally, that the lead is Haitian, and that's why he knows French in a European context with a bunch of Americans. I thought that was good.
But, yeah, this also, I think, is up there and really exceeds the movie Zone Troopers from 1985 that was written by the writers of The Rocketeer, Danny Bilson and Paul DeMeo, and that one starred Tim Thomerson, who's into a lot of B-movies and stuff, and that one had soldiers in Italy during World War II, and they dealt with a UFO, and that one kind of got more into B-movie Amazing Stories kind of territory, you know, like the books, the magazines, as far as the strange designs for the ships and stuff. Whereas this, you know, but they kept the soldier stuff very realistic. And this, I kind of had that similar feeling where they kind of played it serious with the soldiers and all that, and then, you know, added this, the gore and everything. That's kind of like the lesson learned from one of the Wolfenstein games. So I can't remember which one it was. I think it was the one with the alternate timeline, the first one that did that. It was very exploitative of the atrocities, and there was a little too much imagery that was reminiscent of the Holocaust, and they actually fixed that tonally and visually in the more recent one before it went off the rails, and they really handled it much better. You know, the one where you start in the wheelchair, they kind of found a better tone, and they even did it where they don't make you feel guilty for killing all the Nazis either.
That and the original are the only Wolfensteins I really know. I don't actually know the intervening ones, really.
Yeah, I think the one I was thinking of was the New World Order, the New Order, or something like that was the one. I played that one. It was a little tasteless in how it treated some of the bad experiments that the bad guys were doing, and the Nazi scientists and stuff. They rectified it, but for me, you know, as a game, the other one, though, the more new one, traumatized me over the whole deal with your father making you decide whether or not to kill your dog. That shows how games can be art, and just as much as movies, and how they can touch you and trigger you.
The dramatic stuff and the sort of comedic, just the general scripting was quite well done.
Yeah, it had a good tone. It knew when to be serious, when to be campy, when to be scary, and all that. Another one that I think, just like that game, but just like this last movie, Overlord, is a horror movie of where American horror movies started getting better again, is It Follows.
Definitely.
That was a very interesting movie and very scary. And it was very interesting, too. It was like, it kind of took place in a liminal, unsure timeline or setting. Because, you know, they had these cell phones that were like, you know, makeup things, you know, that they flipped open. So it was like, that's not quite our time. It's not the 70s or the 80s. Yeah, so it was really hard to tell time periods. But they were able to shoot it visually looking like the 80s or something. Yeah.
And it felt like an 80s movie.
But they somehow had cell phones. Yeah,
it very much felt like an 80s movie, just in terms of the shooting style. As you said, not necessarily the setting, just the feel of it was very 80s. But yeah, no, I totally agree. It's very much an early entry in that kind of 2010s renaissance of like interesting Western horror, essentially. It was a major early stab in it, where it sort of takes the sort of slasher movie genre stuff and the sexual themes associated with like a lot of teen horror. It does something with them. I think it's just worth watching.
Yeah. I think it's in the same vein and maybe does it better, something like Jennifer's Body. It's like it's taken what Jennifer's Body did and run with it and really going there.
Yeah. Certainly in terms of the like sexual connotations of teen horror. Yeah, and I do think it's a better movie, but I'm not sure it's necessarily exactly setting out to do quite the same thing with the genre material. But I get what you're saying. It's making the sort of the sexual and gendered themes explicit and exploring them.
Yeah, and it's turning the old stuff, the old cliches and tropes on their head while, you know, using them, you know, making fun of them. Another one that I thought was really good that used the sex stuff to a very interesting way, a predatory creature, predatory individual or whatever, was the Under the Skin with Scarlett Johansson. What's a good way to explain that without spoiling it too much?
Well, as you say, it's all about predatory behavior. And I think it's probably not a spoiler to say it's about with the question of whether Johansson's character is predatory. It's very artistically shot.
It's a genre movie.
It's a genre movie, but it's a very nicely shot genre movie. Definitely one that's playing with questions of gender and power and all that. It's also not too, it doesn't feel too exploitative, or like, I wouldn't put like a massive trigger warning on it, if that makes sense. I think it's quite restrained in how it deals with those aspects.
And another one that I would rec is Assassination Nation, which is a very good one that was kind of a modern retelling of the Salem witch trials, but with like thinking of something like Kiwi Farms and social media and doxing and all that kind of stuff, because it was about these girls that get doxed and blamed for a bunch of stuff, and the whole town goes after them. It's got a really good cast. Joel McHale, a whole lot of people are in it. Yeah, it's like an action horror. It's like a really good in how it balances the tones and themes and everything.
So for the 2020s, as was last year, it's obviously too early to call the best of the decade, but we'll take a stab, as it were. A number of these weren't exactly overlooked last year, as they either hadn't been released at all or weren't available in this country. So this is more of a work in progress update. There's already a lot of interesting work coming out just in the first 2 years of this decade. So in general, one recent improvement in the genre is the greater diversity of creatives behind the camera. It's not that these are the first horror movies to address racism or sexism or other socially conscious themes, but even the most socially conscious horror in previous decades still tended to be made by white men. So in that spirit, I'm going to briefly rate three horrors, both written and directed by women in the 2020s, all addressing gender as a theme. Although their politics could be debated for years, they're not beyond criticism. One in particular of these, I've seen a lot of debates about what the politics actually are. But firstly, I Blame Society, Gillian Wallace Horvath's willfully cringy mockumentary that eviscerates superficial Hollywood feminism with a particularly hilarious closing line and shot. Secondly, Titan, or Titane as it reads to an Anglophone, which won last year's Palme d'Or at Cannes. A body horror which starts as apparently a satire of mechanophilia or car fetishism, like a more ludicrous version of Cronenberg's Crash. The original Crash, it's very cold. It's like the sort of the least erotic movie about sex ever made. Whereas I think Titan, like, I think it's satirical, but it much more embraces the kind of eroticism and does it in a really kind of over the top way.
Yeah, I thought that Crash was intentionally cold as far as its tone and the whole point of the movie.
I agree. I'm more saying that I think the two directors deliberately take different tonal approaches to the same sort of subject matter. So it's kind of contrast just in terms of tone. One of them feels very cold and the other is kind of almost taking the kind of the male gaze to a really absurd level, at least in the first act of the movie. Then it veers sharply into a sort of kitchen sinky story of gender dysphoria and found family that is, if nothing else, a huge can of worms. A lot of the debate I've seen about this movie centers more on the middle act of the movie than the first act, mechanophilia stuff, especially the gender dysphoria and kind of what it's saying about gender dysphoria. So a lot of us are still not quite sure what to make of Titan. But in any case, writer-director Julia Ducournau is clearly both very talented and very provocative. Do you have any comments on that one?
I have not seen this, but it definitely seems like it's in conversation with Crash.
It absolutely is. And Ducournau in general is a big body horror person. She also made Raw, which was about cannibalism. And finally, there's Mimi Cave's debut, Fresh, released this year, and ironically stylish satire about designer cannibalism.
Put all our hopes of finding happiness through someone else.
Yeah.
Girl, you are all digmatized and I haven't even seen this dude.
What's going on?
I'm gonna tell you, but you're gonna freak out.
No, this isn't happening.
Yeah, it's happening. No games. Know what you wanted?
It's about giving. Giving yourself over to somebody. Becoming one forever. That's love. Forget this.
It's a straight girl's fantasy come true, right?
So another interesting 2022 flick was T. West's X, a 70s exploitation riff with very strong Texas Chainsaw Massacre vibes, a clear love of cinematic trash, also going into playing with pornography because the leads are basically shooting a pornographic film, and kills that play enjoyably with audience expectations. If you like 70s grindhouse trash, you'll probably enjoy this a lot. One thing I wasn't so sure about was the portrayal of old people's sexuality as sad and creepy. I've heard different takes on this, some people who think that it's kind of intentionally deconstructing it. I personally kind of found it to be not so well handled, and it was sort of felt like it was contrasting these sort of liberated young people with these repressed old people, and that was one aspect of it that I didn't so much like. But pretty much everything else in the movie was great fun. And it'll be interesting to see how the back-to-back prequel Pearl deals with all this. There may be a long game at work here, which makes it all the more satisfying. But at the time of recording, Pearl hasn't been released here in Aotearoa, and it has been released in the US. Meanwhile, if you enjoy David Cronenberg's body horror, which he kind of hasn't been doing for quite a while, he recently returned to his roots with Crimes of the Future, decent execution of a script he wrote in the 90s, It's nice to see something with practical effects in the year of our Lord 2022. It has the kind of coldness we talked about in Crash. It feels very cold. It's the sort of thing that's probably best enjoyed if you're already a Cronenberg stan and maybe alienating otherwise. But pro tip, if you're confused, don't take it too seriously. It's best enjoyed as a kind of dark comedy. More prominently, Nope lived up to expectations. At once, Jordan Peele's most straightforward movie and his most elusive, I found. Like, the story in a way was straightforward, but any of it was getting it thematically. It was quite hard to decrypt, and there's definitely material there, but it takes a lot of thinking to kind of get out of it. So it's kind of densely packed exploration of cinematic spectacle, engaging with kind of the history of cinematic spectacle, as well as kind of interaction of human and non-humans in cinematic spectacle. It was like also multiple generations of cinematic technology. So it's a film about film, essentially. And I personally rank Us and Get Out above it, but they're all great. Any comments on that one?
It's very Spielbergian, very intentionally. It reminded me a lot about Jaws without spoiling anything, but pretty clear what this movie's about, and I had to hurry up and see it before anybody spoiled it in reviews on YouTube or anywhere.
Definitely Spielberg. I actually also think M. Night Shyamalan, as much as I don't like most of his movies, I kind of think this is like a good M. Night Shyamalan movie.
It's like a good version of Signs.
Exactly, yes. Like a good version of Signs, which I'm not a fan of that movie. But not only I said a film about films, it's also a blockbuster about blockbusters, and does that very well.
Yeah, and I think it's almost call it now for Nope, I think.
I don't know if that's even my favorite that I've seen of the early 2020s. Titan for me is in the running. As I say, still trying to process that movie, but that's in the running as well. But, you know, Nope is a great movie. As I say, if Nope is not necessarily the best in a bunch of movies, then that's a good bunch of movies.
Yeah, because too, when you think of the fact that Jordan Peele has yet to do the remake of People Under the Stairs, we just don't know where things are going yet.
But unlike Nope, one that for me didn't quite live up to expectations was Alex Garland's Men. After two really excellent works as a writer-director, as well as many significant contributions as just a writer, you know, obviously 28 Days Later, Sunshine, Dread, this struck me as a little shallower than it thought it was, although definitely still worth a watch. A below average Alex Garland is still an above average movie generally.
What year was Mandy made?
That is 2010s, I can't remember the exact year, because Color Out of Space was like a bridge 2019-2020 movie, and that I think it got a festival release at the end of 2019 and then a broader release in 2020. Point being, that was after Mandy, so Mandy would have been like 2018 or something. But yeah, but that's also a great movie. But that's it for the 2020s.
If you like tonight's show, it was written from the dreams of the old one. Have a happy Halloween. Be safe with all those ghosts among us, and we'll see you in hell. And we'll... What was that? Who are you?
Your biggest fan.
Oh my God!